Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading an article today from the April-May 2026 issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. So I hope you enjoy the program today. This is part of the Smithsonian's Celebrating America at 250. The title is Drafting the Revolution. Taverns, public houses, and inns served as unofficial headquarters for the American rebels. Some are still standing, including these, where you can raise your glass in memory of the founders. It's by Noah Letterman. We held our meetings at the Green Dragon Tavern, Paul Revere wrote in a letter, careful that our meetings should be kept secret. Soon-to-be founding fathers and other patriots like Revere found great value in the American public house. It was a place to trade stories, to learn of critical world events, and to strategize. They railed against British tyranny, plotted protests against loathsome policy, and read aloud from Thomas Paine's Common Sense or from the Declaration of Independence while sipping toddies. At taverns, militias recruited soldiers, held military tribunals, stored military supplies and rations, and hosted patriot groups like the Sons of Liberty. Most taverners supported these gatherings at their establishments because they often felt the crushing British tariff on raw ingredients for spirits or on printed goods like playing cards. Revolution would be a boon for business. Today, most colonial-era taverns are gone, but as our country turns 250, a few stalwart pubs remain, holding the hopes and stories of the revolutionary Americans who fought to form a democratic nation. As we celebrate America's independence, consider lifting a foggy beer stein at one of these taverns. The Wright Tavern, Concord, Massachusetts. In October 1774, the first Massachusetts Provincial Congress met in Concord. Samuel Adams and John Hancock began the process of separating the 13 colonies from Britain, made plans to redirect the people's taxes from the crown to the provincial Congress, and established the idea that the government's power came from the will of the people. During and after the meeting, some reportedly went right next door to Mr. Taylor's Tavern, now Wright Tavern, to celebrate these bold steps by getting sloshed. On April the 19th, 1775, in the wee hours of morning, having been warned of approaching redcoats, colonial militiamen gathered at the tavern to plan their maneuvers and then left, ending up in the nearby hills. Later that morning, 700 British regulars rode into Concord to capture the colonists' stockpiled weapons. The redcoats then commandeered Wright Tavern as their headquarters. Today, a replica of a line engraving by the colonial artisan Amos Doolittle, hanging just inside the entrance, depicts the British gathering before the tavern. When the redcoats met the militiamen at the North Bridge, about a mile down the road, both sides fired, resulting in the first casualties for the crown. 6 decades later, Concord native Ralph Waldo Emerson would refer to the instigation of that skirmish as the shot heard round the world. By 1793, Wright Tavern had ceased operations, and over the next 2 centuries, the building had dozens of other uses. It was a bakery, a wig manufacturer, and a kindergarten, where 195 kids signed the 1864 Little People's Petition to President Abraham Lincoln, calling for enslaved children to be freed. Today it is a museum open to the public Fridays through Sundays, and also hosts private events. In the fall, tavern service will return so that visitors can enjoy colonial-era drinks like Stone Fences, rye or rum mixed with applejack and hard cider, and Flip, a rum cocktail made with molasses, spices, and a raw egg that was once cooked into a froth with a hot poker from the fireplace. Wright no longer uses the hot poker. The second tavern is Franz's Tavern at New York City. Many of the original gray-yellow bricks of Franz's Tavern hold firm with their original 18th-century oyster-shell mortar along Broad Street in Lower Manhattan. When Samuel Francis purchased the tavern in 1762, he marked his establishment with a sign bearing Queen Charlotte's likeness, and the public called it the Queen's Head Tavern. But inside, royalty was despised. During the 1770s, the Sons of Liberty met at Francis to plot out New York's Tea Party protests. Adams and Hancock visited to devour oysters, and the New York Provincial Congress used Francis to hold meetings and one court-martial, as well as parties including a barn burner on June 18, 1776. With George Washington in attendance, they made 31 toasts, drank 109 bottles of wine, and paid £91, equivalent to about $26,000 today, plus 16 additional shillings for broken wine glasses. It was also the site of perhaps the biggest party to celebrate Evacuation Day, November 25th, 1783, when the British left New York City after more than 7 years, marking the end of the war and the birth of a nation. That evening, New York's Governor George Clinton gave a public dinner at Francis Tavern. George Washington joined in 13 toasts to the new nation, to lost heroes, to America's future as an asylum to the persecuted of the earth, and to the hope that this day will be a lesson to princes. 9 days later, Francis Tavern hosted a more lachrymose occasion. The patriot spymaster Benjamin Talmadge recalled the lamentations that followed Washington as the latter left New York to return to Mount Vernon. "Such a scene of sorrow and weeping I had never before witnessed, and fondly hope I may never be called to witness again." Today, visitors to Francis Tavern can toast, like Washington, with a punch cocktail of rum and whiskey, flavored with peach tea and lemon juice, a nod to a time when fresh ingredients were rare. The third one is Ye Old Centerton Inn in Pittsgrove, New Jersey. Brian Good and his wife Joan were chefs who had worked at some of New York City's most famous restaurants, including La Bernardine and Jean Georges, respectively. But when the town towers fell in 2001, they sought a new start outside the city and moved to the town of Elmer in one of the most rural parts of New Jersey, and in 2003 bought Ye Old Centerton Inn at nearby Pittsgrove. Built in 1706, the two-story inn was a stop on the stagecoach route from Bridgeton, New Jersey, to Philadelphia, where travelers came for pints and a bed. Based on an 1803 deed, we can determine that the original 18th-century rooms comprised the bar area, the dining room behind it, and the second story. the inn may have held munitions for the Continental Army. Brian Good recounts the legend that Patriot militiamen once killed two loyalists here and buried the bodies under the fireplace. But there's no way to substantiate things, he laments. Next up is the Middleton Tavern in Annapolis, Maryland. Traveling from Virginia to Philadelphia was arduous in the 1700s, but meetings of the Continental Congress in the North required Southern delegates to leave their plantations and make the long journey. To trim many hours and miles off the ride, Horatio Middleton's ferry out of Annapolis, Maryland, offered a shortcut across the Chesapeake Bay. While Middleton claimed in an ad in the Maryland Gazette that he keeps the best entertainment, as good boats and hands, as any that crossed the bay. Boats crossing the bay weren't so reliable. One ferry carrying George Washington ran aground twice, nearly costing the president his life. Another boat got stuck while ferrying Tench Tilghman, one of Washington's aide-de-camp, while he carried surrender documents from British General Charles Cornwallis north to Philadelphia. As a ferry owner, Middleton needed a tavern where customers could gamble and drink while waiting for passage. In 1750, Middleton purchased a sturdy building erected on a stone foundation with brick walls and oyster shell grout. The construction helped the tavern survive a 1938 hurricane and two fires in the 1970s. In November 1783, Annapolis became the nation's capital for the better part of a year, and the tavern would have been busy with associates of Benjamin Franklin, one of whom once requested that debtors meet him at the tavern to make speedy payment. Middleton's bustled with members of the Maryland Jockey Club, the Freemasons, and the Tuesday Club, a social organization comprising the city's self-styled elite, such as Middleton's son Samuel. According to Tuesday Club records, raucous members visited Middleton's to sing, dance brisk jigs, play music and drink, good rack punch, and claret. Today, guests can eat like colonists, enjoy daily rockfish offerings and oyster shooters served with cocktail sauce and Natty Bow beer, a Maryland favorite dating back to the first Cleveland administration. Next up is the White Horse Tavern in Newport, Rhode Island. Built in 1652, this tavern served in its early days as the meeting place for the Rhode Island colony's General Assembly, as well as the City Council and the Criminal Court. By 1702, William Mays, Jr., a notorious pirate who'd prowled the Indian Ocean, succeeded his father as innkeeper and received a license to sell all sorts of strong drink. 6 years later, the businessman's lunch was supposedly invented there, as councillors began dining at the tavern and charging meals to the public treasury. By 1730, new owners trotted out the tavern's new sign, an image of a white horse. During the war in 1776, the owners left Newport when British troops and Loyalist allies turned the white horse into their own accommodations. Today, you won't see much of a rabble at the White Horse. It's now an establishment for Newport's upper crust. Next is the Red Fox Inn and Tavern in Middleburg, Virginia. In 1728, using local fieldstone, Joseph Chin built Chin's Ordinary, a tavern in Middleburg, midway between bustling Alexandria and Winchester on the Ashby Gap trading route. Being dead center gave rise to the town's name, Middleburg, when it was chartered in 1787. George Washington was Chinn's cousin, and when the first president rolled through town to visit family, he might have stayed at the inn, or at least had a drink there. Chinn's Ordinary became the Beverage House in 1812. In the Civil War, it served as a Confederate hospital during the 1863 Gettysburg Campaign, and the headquarters for General J.E.B. Stuart, who hatched battle plans upstairs. Today, visible square nail heads in non-uniform width floorboards appear consistent with 1800s design. In 1937, the property was revamped and expanded to become the Red Fox Inn, a more luxurious property surrounding the original tavern, which became popular with the Kennedys. Jackie Kennedy Onassis frequented the inn during her fox hunting outings. Next is the Griswold Inn, Essex, Connecticut. Beneath a domed ceiling made of horsehair and crushed clam shells, the Griswold Inn's tavern boasts a large and handsome collection of maritime art. In the other rooms, there's an antique firearm collection and a rich history of chaos and gaiety. The tavern room began life as a schoolhouse in 1735, but graduated to become a tavern in 1801, though not before townspeople watched the building roll down Main Street on logs pulled by a team of oxen to the tavern's current location. Owners maintain that the Griswold Inn has been in continuous operation since 1776. Although none of the famed revolutionary rabble-rousers are known to have visited the Griswold Inn, the tavern does have a musket that had in its barrel a note from a father to his son, encouraging Junior to take up arms and join ye ranks of ye Washington. The Griswold Inn was commandeered by the British during the 1814 raid on Essex, a site of temperance movement protests. The banners still hang inside. It was also where Frederick Law Olmsted is rumored to have celebrated his commission to design Central Park. And lastly, Pirate's House in Savannah, Georgia. The Pirate's House consists of a number of conjoined historical buildings, including the Herb House, which is considered the oldest standing structure in the state of Georgia, built in 1734 on the site of the Trustee's Garden, the first public experimental garden in the colonies where colonists grew cotton and peaches. The Herb House served as the gardener's accommodations. The Pirate's House started operating as a tavern in 1753. Its hot blue shutters and doors ostensibly ward off ghosts. In the mid-1700s, legends tell pirates began using tunnels under the tavern to kidnap unwary imbibers, including, per one legend, a local constable. Pirate associations continued in the next century. It's said Scottish writer Robert Louis Stevenson's visit to the Pirate's House helped inspire his 1883 novel, Treasure Island. Pages from an early edition of the novel are on display in a tavern chamber known as the Treasure Room. And that completes the first article today. The writer, Noah Lederman, is the author of A World Erased, A Grandson's Search for His Family's Holocaust Secrets. And the name of his article was Drafting the Revolution. Next is an article from the prologue section of the magazine, under the American icon. The article is titled Road Shows. In these classic movies, brash, gritty, sometimes outrageous, Route 66 Plays a Starring Role by Brandon Tinsley. Number 1, The Grapes of Wrath. In this 1940 film, adapted from John Steinbeck's novel, the Joad family leaves Oklahoma amid the Great Depression and heads along Route 66 toward the promise of California. The New York Times lauded the Dust Bowl migration tale as deserving of a place on a small, uncrowded shelf devoted to the cinema's masterworks. Number 2 is Easy Rider. In Easy Rider, two men score big in a Los Angeles cocaine deal, then ride toward Mardi Gras in New Orleans. Directed by Dennis Hopper, the 1969 film cast Route 66 as a symbol of freedom and helped push Hollywood onto a new road of its own, ushering in an era when directors with distinct voices and visions began to run the show. Number 3, Two-Lane Blacktop. Starring the singer-songwriter James Taylor and Beach Boys co-founder Dennis Wilson, Monty Hellman's 1971 cult film tracks a group of young street racers tearing through the Southwest. The movie evokes a bittersweet moment not long before Route 66's two lanes were outnumbered by interstate highways. Number 4, Rain Man. In Barry Levinson's 1988 dramedy, brothers Charlie, Tim Cruise, and Raymond, Dustin Hoffman, travel from Cincinnati to L.A. to claim an inheritance. They follow stretches of Route 66, visiting landmarks like the Big 8 Motel in El Reno, Oklahoma. The journey to the West and into the past helps bridge the brothers' estrangement. And lastly, Cars. In John Lasseter's 2006 animated film, Lightning McQueen, a talking race car, is headed to an important race, but winds up stranded in the fictional town of Radiator Springs, once a major stop on Route 66. He learns of the highway's bygone greatness. Cars didn't drive on it to make good time, one resident recalls. They drove on it to have a good time. And that completes the title of the article, Road Shows, by Brandon Tinsley. There isn't enough time for another article, so I'm going to the Smithsonian's question and answer section. With this question, before personal timekeeping was common, how did early Americans arrange meetings and keep appointments? And here's the answer. Although relatively few people in early America owned clocks and watches, they were able to rely on other sources to track time. Most of the population lived in rural areas, and the sun, not mechanical timepieces, ruled the day. Almanacs gave information about lunar and solar cycles, so people could keep track of planting seasons and market dates. In the military, soldiers got their signals through the sound of a bugle or a drum. In a city like Boston, people who lived within earshot of the Old North Church, for example, could mark the time by mechanical clocks that rang on the hour. Sundials were also surprisingly accurate. When people did begin owning clocks and watches, they used sundials to set them to the minute. In general, early Americans, even businessmen in towns, didn't schedule appointments to the minute or rush to beat the clock. They maintained a different pace of life. That answer comes to us from Carlene Steffens, a retired curator of work and industry at the National Museum of American History. The second question, are there any planets in space that don't orbit around a star? The answer, as planetary systems form, it's theoretically possible that some planets whose orbits haven't fully stabilized could be kicked out of their own star systems through close gravitational encounters with other planets or stars. In stellar nurseries, where many new solar systems are forming, the James Webb Space Telescope has detected hundreds of isolated objects smaller than Jupiter. These might be planets, based on their small mass. However, they might be miniature brown dwarfs, failed stars that are too small to fuse hydrogen the way our sun does. Demonstrating that ejected, free-floating planets exist and do not have host stars is part of the mission of the upcoming Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. That answer comes from Jennifer C. Yee, the observational astronomer at the Center for Astrophysics, Harvard and Smithsonian. With that, we have run out of time. That ends the broadcast. You've been listening to the Smithsonian Magazine, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona, the April-May 2026 issue. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader. I hope you found the program enjoyable and informative. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and thank you so much for spending your time with me today.